This podcast is brought to you by the School of Advanced Study, University of London. All of our podcasts are available from our website, www.sas.ac.uk.
It's a great pleasure for me to... the Dean apologises for not being here. Somehow or other, his homiletics is not quite where he'd like it to be at this point. He's double-booked. And he's very sorry. But anyway, I'm now going to... It's a great pleasure of introducing Peter Tull. He's the long-term Francis Yates Fellow at the Warburg Institute, as almost all of you know. He's working on the medieval reception of early Christian sermons and on the connections between the reception of those sermons, medieval religious dialogues, and particularly the religious theatre and the mystery plays in particular. He's a PhD from Budapest in Egyptology and Classics. He worked for 10 years in the manuscript collection of the University Library in Budapest and made a catalogue of the medieval Latin manuscripts of that library and published many newly discovered items while he was working on that. And today he's going to talk about Prophet's Play, personifying the Old Testament from early Christian homiletics to medieval drama.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction, especially for assuming to act as the dean and chairing the session. When I was preparing, so you see, prophets are here, so we have to go into them now. And when I was trying to find, I was preparing for this talk, and I was trying to find a good introduction to give an insight of what I would like to speak about today. I was trying to find something very bad, and then it happened that I found a passage, a short sentence in a book by Joseph Hillis Miller, who is writing about the Virgin's Pygmalion and the different aspects and dimension of the Pygmalion story as an allegory. And in the very first page of the book, I found this curious and very apt sentence where he describes the whole legend or the whole image of Pygmalion as a kind of paradigm or a model where we can see the terrible performative power that figures of speech may have, because these tropes, the figures of speech, tend to materialize in the real world. So as he interprets the story of Pygmalion, this is a kind of allegory for the personification, for the power of the prosopopoeia, the personification of something which does not have a life in itself, but due to the personification, it can come into life, act like a being, and materialize and appear in the physical real world. And that's the very meaning of the Pygmalion story, according to him. And when I read this sentence in this book, I realized that it is exactly what I would like to speak about today. The power of the figures of speech, the figures of rhetoric, the power of the human speech itself, but it is in a completely different case, so it's not Pygmalion's story, but it is about a special method of quoting the Old Testament passages with which I would like to illustrate the truth of this particular description, or sentence, or summary. So, I would like to show you a story, a reconstruction of a story of a particular method of quoting the Old Testament, which constitutes the framework for a very interesting and curious game where the speakers and writers, Christian intellectuals, are playing with the Old Testament citations and texts in the most particular ways. And by doing this, they are creating new prompts from the quotations, from fictitious monologues, dialogues, up to whole narratives, which all these figures in the Western European tradition of the Middle Ages will have a very special afterlife, as we will see at the end of the talk. But in order to understand what's going on here and how is it possible to play with the sacred texts of the Old Testament, we have to be aware and we have to understand the importance of the Old Testament quotations for the Christian literature and the Christian intellectuals. So we have to go back to a period when the emerging Christianity was about to separate from its Judaic environment, and it was about to define itself as the continuation, on the one side, of the Jewish traditions, but also as the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies So for Christian intellectuals who were arguing either against the Jews to convince them that Christ was the real and much expected savior, or they were arguing against the pagans who had the claim that Christianity was nothing else but a newly invented reason sect, they made extensive use of the Old Testament as a kind of treasury to show up the roots of Christianity in the legendary past for the pagans, and for the connection, to show up the connections between the Jewish heritage and the newly emerging Christianity. So it's not one, it's not surprising at all that there is a very strong emphasis made always on the typological connection between the Old and the New Testaments in these scriptures, from the Gospels onwards, and also in the other New Testament genres. The importance of the Old Testament is just a quotation from the Gospel of Luke, where the conversion of the two disciples going to the village of Emmaus is achieved by this particular moment when Christ, who is given from them, he is explaining to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. And it is the moment when they realize that this is really Christ who is speaking to him, to them. And this very, very important role of the Old Testament in the early Christian literature and discourse is described nowadays by a scholar like Hagit Amiral as a cornerstone in the consolidation of distinctive Christian identities. And he calls this very strong emphasis on the importance of the Old Testament as the adoption and appropriation of the Jewish scriptures. So we can see how important it was for the Christian literature, Christian tradition, to emphasize its connections to the Old Testament. So it's not surprising at all that we find a lot of quotations all over the Christian literary documents, from the Gospels onwards, through the other New Testament genres, up to the patristic literature. And it's also not surprising that if someone could find a really good quotation which turns to be the foreshadowing of a particular Christian event of a particular Christian doctrine in the Old Testament, this quotation was kept by the others and used all the time, all over, again and again, in the Christian literature. So we have these quotations which are coming up again and again in Christian literature. They are highlight quotations. They are always there when something about the Christian doctrines is argued or disputed. But if we check these quotations against the biblical original text, we will find some curious problems of these certain odd quotations. What are these problems? I would like to show you three highlight quotations and the problems related to them. One of the favorite quotations of the Church Fathers, which is used all the time when they are speaking about the birth of Christ from a virgin, it's the famous quotation from Isaiah, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive." I've selected a passage from the 2nd century Justin, from his first apology against the Jews, but I could have done it from many other writings. And if we check the quotation from Isaiah against the Greek version of the Old Testament and the original Hebrew text of Isaiah, we will find two major differences. One is the difference in the verb. So "they will call" has Justin, and "you shall call" or "you shall name him" in the original text. That's what we have. So in Justin it's the third person plural. In the original biblical text it's the second person singular, because in the original context it is addressed to King Ezekiel as a kind of sign from God to him. That's why it's addressed to him, that "you will call the name of the little boy as Emmanuel." And the other difference is that the very name of the nascent little infant is translated into Greek by Justin, and not kept in the original Hebrew version. But if we check the use and the application of the quotation in the Gospel of Matthew, we will find exactly the same form in the Gospel as in Justin's work. So we would assume that, okay, Justin has just quoted not from the original biblical text, but from Matthew. But arguing against the Jewish scholar, what he actually does in this work, who is an expert on the Old Testament writings, it seems a bit odd. Why to write a Christian form of Old Testament quotation? Why to use it against a Jewish scholar? So the answer, the solution, was formulated by some scholars that there might be some kind of intermediary resource between the biblical original and the quotation of Justine. And this assumption is supported by another very, very beloved quotation, which is always used as an Old Testament prefiguration of the incarnation of God on the earth, which is coming from the book of Peru. This is our God, and there shall no other be like him. And he was seen upon the earth and conversed with man. It is especially this latter part of the quotation, which was very important for the incarnation. But if we check the use of the quotation, it's sometimes quoted anonymously without any name, but most generally it's always attributed to Jeremiah, which is not a misattribution, it should be in brackets. It's just an archaism, because Baruch was regarded as a disciple of Jeremiah, so the collection of his prophecies was placed as an appendix to the writings of Jeremiah into the same scroll. So the attribution of the quotation to Baruch is just a sign that it comes from the scroll, the Jeremiah scroll, and not from Jeremiah himself. But when the books were not preserved and not copied in scrolls anymore, the quotation always remained the same, and it is, even in the Middle Ages, it's always attributed to Jeremiah instead of Peleus. So there could be some intermediary source between the original biblical text and the quotations here as well. And there is a third case, which is again a very much used and a very favorite one, coming from the book of Deuteronomy, which is quoted here by Eusebius in the early 4th century as a saying by Moses himself, as an attestation that Moses knew that there will be an even greater prophet than him who will come and save the people of Israel. But if you check this quotation in Eusebius' work against the biblical originals, we will find that it's a composite quotation, which is conflated from different little words of different verses of the same chapter of the book of Deuteronomy into one saying, which is placed into the mouth of Moses. And exactly the same form comes up in the Acts of the Apostles, in the speech, in the long speech of Peter, when he is convincing the Jews with Old Testament quotations, and he has exactly the same composite and conflated form of the quotation, just like Eusebius. But again, if we check the original form of the text, the meaning of the prophecy in the original biblical text is almost or exactly the same. So one cannot see any point in quoting a philologically and historically incorrect version of the quotation instead of the biblical original, which should mean almost the same. So what is the explanation for this curious incorrect quotation? The answer for this question was found at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, and especially by the researches of James Randall Harris, who at the very beginning of the 20th century tries to find the background of these incorrect quotations, and he found the answer in assuming that there were some collections which contained pre-selected quotations for the different aspects and topics of Christian argumentation against the Jews and the heretics and the pagans as well. So according to him, there might have been collections arranged under different headings collecting the quotations which are thought to be proving different aspects of the Christian doctrines, as quotations attesting to the virgin birth of Christ, his passion, his death, and so on. And there was another type of collection which was arranged under catchwords. In these chapters, or in these groups of quotations, those biblical passages were collected and put together which contained the same catchword, as for example the coming of the Lord was emphasized in several passages in the Psalms. They were collected as quotations foreshadowing the coming of the Lord. That was Harris's assumption, and he actually managed to find quite a few extant collections which contained arranged quotations exactly in the same manner. So the earliest one is a Latin collection made by Cyprian of Carthage, in the 3rd century, and its title is Testimonials, Witnesses Against the Jews, to a certain Quirinus. And there are two other Greek collections arranged exactly in the same manner, under headings, quotations, as we have it in the title of the second one, the Pseudo-Epiphanius one. The title reads as Testimonies of the Holy Scriptures Concerning the Coming from Heaven to Earth of the Word of God. That was the first chapter of the collection. And then the Miracles Made by Him on the Earth. That was the second chapter. And His Passion and Resurrection and His Second Appearing. So these were the headings which contained the different Old Testament quotations. And the title was again Martyriae, which means witnesses, testimonies against Jews or any kind of opponents of Christianity. So that was the first step to make the use of the Old Testament even more effective in Christian discourse against the opponents of Christendom. So it was now, having these little collections in their hands, it was only up to the Christian intellectuals to use them very carefully and very creatively. The most general, and if we check the quotations in these collections, and that's the main proof for their very, for their great popularity, we will find exactly the same biblical forms in the collections. So for the quotation from Isaiah, we will find exactly this Christianized form in the Pseudo-Epiphanius one and also in Pseudo-Gregory. The same situation we will have with the quotation from Baal, which is, as we see in the Pseudo-Epiphanius collection, is attributed to Jeremiah, as in an introduction Jeremiah says, and then comes Baal. And also the same in Pseudo-Gregory. And we have the same composite quotation from the Book of Deuteronomy in both of the Greek collections, just like we have it in the work of Eusebius and by many, many other authors. And how these testimonial collections and the quotations collected in them were used, the most ordinary and most simple way of making use of them was to name the source and quote the text. So that's what we see in the Epistle to the Romans by Paul, where he makes use of a collection organized by catchwords in arguing for the salvation of the Gentiles, so the expansion of the promise given to Abraham to the Gentiles and the heathens. And he has a long list of quotations which all contain the very word Gentiles, as we see here. He says that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written. And then comes the sequence. Therefore I will praise you among the Gentiles, first one. Again it says, rejoice you Gentiles, second one. And so on, collecting all these verses from the text, which contain the same expression for the pagans. There is the use of the other type of testimonial collections, which is arranged under different headings. We see it in a 5th century Greek homily attributed to Hesychius of Jerusalem, but it's not important for us now. We can see how a chapter about the incarnation in the collection was used by the author in the homily, arguing against the Jews, that you may not believe me, O Jews, says Hesychius, but read the holy forefathers, study your own books, hear what is written in the law of Moses, that's naming the source. Then comes the quotation, the Lord will raise up for you a prophet. And then comes the quotation from Isaiah, Isaiah writes, and the quotation, and Jeremiah cries out. That it is a testimonial collection, it's quite clear, because we have exactly the same forms of the citations in the homily. So we will have a composite quotation from the book of Deuteronomy as the first one, the New Testament form of the quotation from Isaiah as the second one, and the misattribution of the quotation from Baruch to Jeremiah. And it's used according to this system of naming the source and quoting the text, which was the most simple one. And this might have been the practice. Oops. This might have been the practice of, I don't know, listen to. It's frozen. Yes. So as we have seen it before, it's quite slow. I'm sorry. That's the SCS computer. So as we have seen it before, the collections were named as witnesses, martyria, and testimonia. And this seems to suggest that these quotations were used as witnesses in the discourse or the argumentation against the opponents of Christianity. And of course, there was a tradition in the rhetorical tradition about the use of witnesses. In the rhetoric of Aristotle, we find some very useful references to the use of the witnesses. That's the one. Yes. And he speaks a lot about the importance of the witnesses in the rhetorical tradition and especially in the forensic speeches. And he speaks and he distinguishes two types of witnesses when he says that as to witnesses, they are of two kinds, the ancient and the recent. By ancient witnesses, I mean the poets and all other notable persons of the past whose judgments are known to all. The recent witnesses, I mean all well-known persons who have given a decision on any point, so these could be the contemporary persons or the actually present witnesses. And he says as a summary that most trustworthy of all are the ancient witnesses because they cannot be corrupted as the living ones. And we see exactly the same use of the ancient witnesses by the Church Fathers, because for them, the martyria, the testimonia of the Old Testament prophets were the ancient witnesses which cannot be corrupted, and they were also very authoritative figures of the past as being the prophets of the Old Testament. So they actually followed the example or the suggestion of Aristotle when they were quoting the Old Testament texts and prophecies as ancient witnesses. And they did this with the very simple method which we have seen before, naming the source and quoting the text, which might have been the usual way to refer to these ancient witnesses, because in the rhetoric of Aristotle, right after this description of the witnesses, we find some examples how to make reference to the ancient witnesses, and he says that this is a proverb, never do good to an old man, and that's all. It's quoted as a proverb, and then comes the quotation. There's another proverb quoted by Aristotle. So the Christian intellectual seems to be following the suggestions of Aristotle here. But the situation was completely different when they were treating or dealing with an actually present witness in the forensic rhetorical tradition. Because if they were present, it was a completely different situation. And Quintilian addresses the problem with the words that the task of dealing with the evidence of the witnesses actually present in the court, one of great difficulty. And consequently, whether defending or impugning them, the orator employs a twofold armory. And he starts to describe his instructions, how to refute, how to embarrass, make the witnesses shy. And there are several psychological suggestions to refute the witnesses. And as an excellent example for that, we have a passage from the speech of Cicero against Catiline, where he actually handles a present witness who is Catiline, and speaks to him in a very direct manner, as leave the city, Catiline, free the republic from fear, get out into exile. So it's a very direct handling of an actually present witness. But this treatment of a witness could be transferred to the treatment of an ancient witness as well, and it is by the rhetorical figure of the personification, the prosopopoeia, which makes it possible. How to make the ancient witness actually present? It's suggested by Quintilian that it is the rhetorical figure of the prosopopoeia which makes the long-dead ancient witness actually present at the court. And in the latter section of his passage about the personification, he says that we are even allowed in this form of speech to bring down the gods from heaven and raise up the dead. And even cities and peoples may find a voice in the personification. And how it was done, there is a very brilliant example for this in another speech of Cicero, in defense of Sirius, where he's speaking against a woman who is said to be who is said to have corrupted this certain Sirius, and to make a very effective accusation against this woman, he starts to speak as we see here. So I must summon up from the netherworld one of those bearded old men, a man with that long shaggy beard which we see on the ancient statues. So let them, the great Claudius Cecus, Appius Claudius Cecus of the old times, rise up now. And if he can come forth from the dead, he will deal with the woman, saying, "O woman, what have you to do with Sirius?" And there is a long speech placed into the mouth of the long dead hero of the Roman Republic, who was personified and brought to life by Cicero in his speech. But this practice can be observed, or just to tell you the truth, I was trying to find an application of this particular personification practice when it's applied to textual witnesses and textual sources. And in the rhetorical tradition, in the speeches, I couldn't find any. Where I could find was the commentary tradition, which quite surprisingly makes use of this kind of second person introduction of the particular passage which is analyzed in the commentaries. So in a scholar, in an anonymous commentary on the Odyssey of Homer, one particular verse is introduced as an address to the poet himself, as, "How can you sing this, O Homer?" And then comes the quotation, and after that, the explanation is provided by the author. And it's quite frequent in the commentary tradition on Aristotle's work, where we find it in, also in this one, a commentary on the Metaphysics from the 6th century in Greek, where we have an opposition between two places in Aristotle, which are all personified as, "Oh Aristotle, how can you say that the matter is always in motion? For here you state this, and in the degenerazione and corruzione you state a different thing." But the answer, and that's the most important thing, is always provided by the commentator and not the author himself. This is a very important point. And of course, Christian intellectuals made use of the personification of the ancient textual witness quite an early time. In the second century, in Clement of Alexandria, we find a quotation from Homer with exactly the same introduction as an address to the poet. "Sing to us, Homer, now, this verse, but stop because it teaches adultery." So it's the same type of quotation, but the real success of this practice was provided by its use and application for the Old Testament material. And an excellent example is provided by a 5th century homily in Greek attributed to Chrysostom, where the author is quoting a long sequence of Old Testament prefigurations of Christ's life with this introduction: "There is nothing to hinder us to summon up the saints in order that they recite us again the words of God. So tell us everything, O prophets and apostles, from the beginning of Christ's miracles. Tell us first about his descent from heaven to earth." And the prophet answers, and then comes the quotation. "And now tell us about the Annunciation to the Holy Virgin." And there comes the prophet telling his prophecy. So we have here exactly the same thing which we have seen in the speech of Cicero when he summoned up from the dead the long-dead Appius Claudius Cecus, who answered him in fictitious speech, but now the whole method is applied to quoting textual sources, and that's the difference. So it's a kind of combination of the rhetorical, oratorial tradition coming from Cicero and the one which we have seen in the commentaries. Because in the commentaries, the answer was not provided by the personified text. But in the oratorial tradition in Cicero, the answer was provided by the personified person, and the two things is combined into one in the Christian practice when the personified quotations can answer. And that's the model of what's happening here, that the scriptural text which is quoted is personified by the prosopopeia, the personification, which is described in the modern literary studies by Bettina Menke in her book about the prosopopeia as a device which can give the texts ein sprechendes Gesicht, a speaking face, which brings them to life. And this sprechendes Gesicht, this speaking face, in this case, is the face of the prophets, which starts to speak after the personification of the text. And it gets a real character, as if he was a real person. And due to this moment in the personification technique, the quotation starts to speak for itself and can answer, can be asked, and can provide answers. And we have seen the basis of the technique, and now we will go into the dimensions which it offers for the Christian intellectuals and homilies. Because if personified, the quotation is personified and gets a real character, it can act and speak for itself. And this, we can see a very good example for the extension of the technique in the 4th century Cyril of Jerusalem, when he speaks about the entry of Christ to Jerusalem, and he quotes the Old Testament prefigurations of this particular scene in this very manner, when he says that the prophet says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Jerusalem, because your king comes." But, and then comes Cyril, "But kings are many. Of which do you speak, O prophet? Give us a sign which other kings do not have. Give us a sign which is peculiar to this king whose coming you announce." And the prophet answers to this request, saying an extended form of the quotation, because it quotes himself, and there is an addition after the quotation that not on a chariot, he is riding on an ass, not on a chariot. You have a unique sign now of the king who came. Jesus alone of the kings set up on an ass entering into Jerusalem. And then comes Cyril again. We have two signs now, but we want to learn a third one. And a third prophet comes, and the whole discussion and dialogue goes on in the same way. So we have seen another aspect, another dimension of the personification technique, when the quotation personified can be asked, can answer, and can have even a commentary on itself, because it makes a little supplement to the quotation when it quotes itself. So this is these were the two basic steps. But the bravest authors of Christianity in the 5th century could go even beyond this, and they were not satisfied of having speaking and conversing quotations in a timeless eternity. They wanted to have a context for the dialogues of the quotations, and they wanted to create a context for this speech. And we will see an example how they did it, because they wanted to put the interpretation of the texts not only into the speeches of the personified quotations, but also into the context. And for this, they were making use of the exegetical guidelines of late antiquity, which is a very simple approach to the texts. Because the tradition, which comes from the commentary tradition of Homer and other literary texts, teaches that whenever a text is analyzed, there are three main questions which should be answered immediately. We have to find out who the speaker in the text is. That's what we have in Pseudo-Plutarchus. So the main elements of the narratives are the person who is speaking. That's the first question to answer. The second one is the place where it happens. The third one is the time. There are many others, but these are the three basic questions to be answered when dealing with a text. We have the same in Aphtonius when he speaks about the attributes of narrative as the person who acted, the thing which is done, the time at which it happens, and the place in which the whole thing takes place. So these are the main questions which are analyzed when someone approaches a text. And of course it was taken over and borrowed by the Christian exegesis. We have it in this work of Athanasius, when he speaks against the Arians, accusing them with the wrong application of the threefold system, saying that, "And we must, as it is appropriate to do with all the divine scripture, take the text faithfully, according to the three questions, time, person, and matter." So these were supposed to be answered when they were dealing with a text. And they wanted to include this type of explanation into the personification of the quotation in a very peculiar manner. how they did it. We will find a very good example for this, and we will see the workshop of this curious preacher, Pseudo-Epiphanius from the 5th century, in his homily on the burial of Christ, which is written for Holy Saturday. And in this homily, he wants to describe the expectation of the Old Testament prophets for the coming manifestation of Christ's salvation in the netherworld. So he collected a whole group of Old Testament quotations according to the catchwords, as we have seen it before. Two catchwords he was using, one for the presence of the netherworld, the hard deeds, the debts, and the corruption, this is the red, and the manifestation of the salvation. And he put these quotations, selected on the basis of the presence of the catchword, into one group and started to interpret them and explain them according to the threefold system. At stage two, he wanted to find the speaker, who is speaking in these quotations, and of course he identified the speaker of the quotations, as he himself says in the beginning of the homily, the prophets and righteous unceasingly offered up secret mystical supplications. So we have the speakers here with red. He attributed all the quotations to another prophet. So we have the speaker now. Let's see the second question answered by Epiphanius, which is the place where the whole thing takes place. He wanted to find out. And he, in his words, provides the answer for the second question, that it happens in the common prison of Hades, where both righteous and unrighteous for ages past were sleeping. So we have one part of the context, which we will read. And the third and last question to answer is the time when this whole thing happens. And he finds it, he identifies it with the period taking place before the arrival of Christ in the netherworld. What he expresses in the following words, it happens before Christ manifested himself in Hades with his divine and blameless soul, bereft of body but not of divinity. So we have all three aspects of, we have answered all three questions of the exegesis. We have the speaker, we have the time, the place, and there's interpretation coming, hopefully. We have it on the handout. So for safety, I prepare the handout. And this is number three. That's number three on the handout, which contains the interpretation of the quotations according to the three layers of explaining them, which is a narrative at the end. In the common prison of Hades, in the common prison of Hades, where both righteous and unrighteous for ages past were sleeping, the prophets and righteous unceasingly offered up secret mystical supplications to God, begging for deliverance. One cried to God, from the belly of Hades, hearken unto my cry. Another cried, this, and at the end, the God of tender mercies verily heard all these cries, and he manifested himself in Hades with his divine and blameless soul. So, the consummation of the interpretation is a narrative. And that's the very end where this process of personifying the quotations can reach. Because this is the most persuasive way of interpreting the quotations, with personifying them and placing them into an interpretative context, which I wanted to show you here. I have my own computer, but I'm not sure if it's... I tried to describe it with my own words without the help of the presentation. So what actually actually happens here is that the author, our author, takes the biblical quotations which he thinks to be appropriate for his aim, which is to illustrate the expectation of Christ by the Old Testament prophets, and he personifies them, as we have seen before with many other texts. But the addition he makes is the context, which is also which is thought to be a kind of interpretation. So the context itself is an interpretation of the personified quotations according to the exegetical tradition of the Church, which is the answer given for these two, three questions. And I have here just a second. Yes. That's it. That's what I wanted to show you. Which is it? Slideshow.
From Karadzhan.
Yes, that's what happens here, the narrative model, which is the scriptural text, which is personified. And after that, these texts are given ein sprechendes Gesicht, which is the prophet himself, the real character of the prophet. And then they are interpreted according to the three-layer guidelines, and they are provided with place and time. At the end of the whole process is the extra-biblical narrative, which can be called as the apocryphal narrative. So we have here a key for the appearance and the birth of the apocryphal narratives, which seem to come and derive from this particular technique of quoting the Old Testament by personification. And this method was quite widespread in the Greek homiletics of the 5th century, because there are many cases when they applied it and they created new narratives with exactly the same type of practice. So we have a very curious scene in the homily on Lazarus by Hesychius of Jerusalem, when right before the resurrection of Lazarus, the Old Testament prophets are gathering around the soul of Lazarus, who is just about to come up and answer the call of Christ, and they are giving messages to Christ, to Lazarus, to send them to Christ, which are all Old Testament prefigurations of. It's alright now. Hopefully. And there is the other, and there is another scene where the Old Testament quotations are proofs for the mystical wedding of Christ and the personified church, and these are the foretellings of the connection, the mystical connection between Christ and the church, and they are personified to act as helpers and witnesses by the wedding. So we have two differences, and a third one, which is the famous harrowing of hell, preserved in the Gospel of Nicodemus, where we have different assemblies and councils of the prophets who are discussing the appearance of Christ in the netherworld. And these are all Old Testament quotations, selected according to the catchword, the presence of light in them. And after that, they are personified and put into the context of the harrowing of hell in the Gospel of Nicodemus. So that was the final stage of the practice of the personified quotation. Quoting system of practice. But at the end, at this point, there emerges another problem, the problem of the performance. If we have such lively dialogues, monologues, narratives in the homilies, how will they perform? How can we imagine that if there is a homily with such lively dialogues, it was performed by one certain bishop or preacher, but how could he sign the change in the speakers and the whole narrative, how was it acted out? In the recent study of Mary Cunningham, she addresses the question with the words that it is certainly difficult to imagine how one bishop would have delivered such a homily. Would he have adopted different tones or voice? Okay. I was too optimistic to send him away. And Mary Cunningham describes the question as unanswerable, so there is no answer to this question. But I think the reason why they couldn't find any answer for this question is that for the case of the prophetic sermons, for the prophetic appearances, they did not consider the rhetorical tradition, that they are acting, the quotations are acting here as witnesses according to the tradition inherited from Aristotle. Because there was a very well-described and preserved tradition of how to handle the witnesses in the courtroom, especially the ancient witnesses. Because from the extant speeches of the Greek orators and of the Roman orators, we have a screenplay how they used the ancient textual sources as witnesses in the courts. And what we have is a very clear system that all these written documents which were used by the speakers during the speech were read out by different persons. These were the clerks who were asked to read out the documents in order to avoid any kind of confusion or fraud or misuse with the documents which were used during the trial. So they were the official persons to read out every written document which was supposed to use during the speech. And we have an interesting speech by the 4th century BC orator Aeschines, who is making use of an extensive use of the Homeric texts for his case in this speech. And in this extant speech of his, we can see how the whole thing was going on when he asks the clerks, who is called the grammatos in the Greek tradition, to read out the quotations from Homer, and another one, and another one, and another one. Oops. I made the last attempt. I think that's the one. Yes, you can see here, with red, the addresses given by the speaker to the clerk. The clerk shall read to you the verses from Homer. So read please first the verses about this, and then this, and then this. So this was a quite widespread practice in the courtrooms of late antiquity, either in the Greek or in the Roman tradition. In the Roman tradition, the clerk was called the scriba, and we might assume that it was the same thing in the Christian tradition as well. So when they were referring to a document, a written document of the past, they might have used the same technique. So to ask someone else to read out the quotation which was used in the homily, and this person might have been a lector or someone, a member of the choir, who read out the text for the homilist or the speaker. So if we reconstruct the delivery of such a sermon according or in the framework of this Greek-Roman tradition of reading out the witnesses, in the case of perhaps this 5th century Latin sermon for Christmas, we will see that what a persuasive and emotional power it could have had when the texts which are personified are read out by someone else, other person, and not the speaker himself, but in a different intonation with the different voice of a member of the choir. So we have in this in this homily, when the author addresses the Jews, you still do not believe that Christ is the Savior, so I will quote you many witnesses of Christ, and let these confound you that are only hearers of the law, but not doers of it. So come now, Isaiah, he says, bear witness unto Christ. And Isaiah appears. Behold, he says, a virgin shall conceive. The same testimony, the same quotation from the testimony collection, collections with the same New Testament form of the quotation. And then, let me now another witness come forth. You too, of Jeremiah, bear witness unto Christ. And again, the misattributed quotation from Baruch to Jeremiah comes up to the scene as personified and perhaps uttered by someone else than the speaker. So we can imagine how effective this technique of the delivery of such a personified quotation could have been in the church. And this particular sermon was selected as a liturgical reading for the Vigil of Christmas. So it was read from the 6th century onwards every year before the great liturgy of Christmas in the church. And in the 12th century, books, lectionaries, we will find very interesting introduction to this particular sermon in this manuscript from Laon from the late 12th century. We will find the introduction as it's read, as it reads here. This is the big O with blue. This is the order of the prophets. And then comes Isaiah, bearded, clothed in a dalmatic, with red stole hanging halfway down before and behind him. Jeremiah in like fashion. So we have costumes and masks for those people who were reading out the prophecies. But so it is something completely new, a new step in the materialization or the personification technique of the Old Testament quotations. And fortunately, we can see how the whole thing looked like because there is a, and that's what I wanted to show you, and hopefully it will succeed. In this, because it's reconstructed, the content of the manuscript is reconstructed by a Spanish group devoted to the ancient music, and we will see. I selected two prophets to show you the quotations personified, which are taken from the testimonial collection. They have the mistaken and incorrect forms when they are personified in such a manner in this manuscript from Laon. Yes, that's Moses from the Laon manuscript. And then comes the personification in its real form. And that's the end of the quotation. And he goes back. And it goes on in the same manner with all the other prophets. A very short excerpt I would like to show you. When the misattribution to Jeremiah takes place, he even shows that, please come here, and then comes the personified quotation from Baal, misattributed to Jeremiah, as you have seen it in the testimonial collections, which is now personified, actually, in the real world. And then comes the misattributed quotation. He recites exactly the same quotation, that this is our God and he was seen on the earth. So what we have here is a very important step towards the appearance of the theatre, which is not the theatre which we have in the Western theatres of London, but something very new, which has never existed before in the Christian tradition, before the 12th century. And we can see here that it is a kind of a consequence of, or the result of, the same personifying technique. And I've tried to make a model for that as well as the closing slide of the whole talk, which illustrates the terrible performative power of the figures of speech, which I quoted from the book of Miller at the beginning, which tends to materialize in the real world, which actually happens here when the scriptural texts are personified by the figure of personification as speaking quotations and real characters, and they can recite themselves, and after that they can comment on themselves, they can have dialogues with each other or with the speaker himself, they can act as characters in an interpretative context of an apocryphal narrative. At the very end of the story, due to the special delivery of these sermons, they can really materialize in the real physical world as actors whom we could see here in the prophet play from Laon. And afterwards, this prophet play was very much used in the stages of medieval Europe in different cycle plays and introductions to plays. But this is a completely new story which should be analyzed separately. Thank you very much for your patience.
So, I guess we have a few minutes for some questions for
Peter. Well, sorry, I left very convenient in seeing Peter, are we sure of chronology? Because I'm sure you already, when the bishops in the 5th century or whatever were giving these sermons, and some of the clerks were impersonating or reading out the quotations from Jeremiah and from Isaiah and so on. I mean, that could be very similar in appearance even to the long order from Tara.
Yes. I think the only difference could have been the use of the costumes. I think it's a major step in creating the whole impression of representation.
Yes.
And this happens on, as far as we know it now, it happens only in the Western medieval tradition, and only from the 12th century onwards.
Because you actually have those stage directions in the manuscript which say
yes. The
characters have to be wearing these costumes.
Perhaps it has started before that, because here it seems nothing special, so it's just there in the manuscript. So the tradition could perhaps be earlier.
Yes.
But in the patristic tradition and in the Greek manuscripts, we don't have anything like that. So there is no introduction and suggestion about the costumes and masks in the Greek tradition, and in the early Latin tradition it's also missing. So it appears in the Middle Ages, and the reason for that is still quite obscure. So scholars are still disputing and discussing the question, why was it so important to personify the prophets in such an effective and persuasive manner exactly in this period of the Middle Ages? Yes. Some explanations are based on the apocalyptic expectation of the end of times, when the Jews were supposed to convert to Christianity, and this was a kind of major compulsion to them to convert into Christianity because the end of times is approaching, and this is one of the expectations. Another one is based on the notion of representation, the change in the notion of representation in Latin Christianity. So there are many, many explanations for the sudden appearance of this practice, but I don't think the whole thing is solved.
What's important, as manifest by the video, is not just the dramatization, but also the setting to the music, the chanting, which we know.
Yes, but
in the early periods.
That's right. But in the earliest copies, we have the notes, and it's like a Gregorian chant.
Yes.
And this was a later adaptation from Santiago de Compostela, when music was added, and also some vernacular additions. So there were introductions describing who this person is, because the congregation perhaps couldn't understand the Latin. So there was an introduction given in the vernacular that now this is Jeremiah, who is this prophet and prophet, and this prophet living in this and this time, so please hear him. And then came the Latin text. So it was a later adaptation, but the content of the text is exactly the same as we have in the Latin manuscript.
Thank you, that was wonderful, and it really, to my mind, a very persuasive account of the movement from rhetorical practice in the courts. So I have a comment and a question. I'll start with a question, which is that I wonder if you have to go as far back as Aristotle. What I'm thinking is that, given that you're working in the period of the Church Fathers, I wonder if looking to the court practices or indeed the oratorical practices, would be more precise, of the second sophistic, would be a more immediate kind of source, just to see the ways in which they translate that, the representation or the personification of witnesses in terms of the kinds of speeches and I don't want to say court practices so much as oratorical practices of the second Smith, which would just be more, contemporary. But the second thing, this is just more fuel for your argument. This is more proof for your argument. You made a case about the early exegetical practice that uses who, what, where, when, why, person, time, place, and so forth. The origins of that are in rhetoric. It's in the attributions of the person in the act in Cicero's De Emotione, but where it's really crystallized as those five points is in the fourth book of Boethius' De Differentiis Topicus, where he says, this is what rhetoric does, and this is how you surround a hypothesis. It's all about these are the so-called circumstances. So, in other words, just more fuel for your argument that this really does originate this. What you saw as an exegetical practice of what was the early Church Fathers actually has a deep rhetorical past. So, yeah.
Yes, thank you. I think in the literature you can see sometimes that the whole issue of the three questions is deriving from Hermogenes.
Hermogenes.
The Stases of Hermogenes.
Yeah, yeah. Hermogenes the Temnus. Hermogenes is the one who does. Better help me here. Hermogenes is the one who does the Progrimnus Mater.
Hermogenes is later. Yeah, I think Hermogenes will be the source.
Yeah, Hermogenes is the source of status theory. That's right.
Yes,
yeah.
And perhaps there is a more direct source. Yes,
well, the direct source for them, for your people, Hermogenes is lost. We don't have him.
Yes.
He's gone. But the direct source. The best source is really Boethius. It's the fourth book of his.
And also Livanius, because he was the teacher of John Chrysostom and Basil the Great. So they were actually students of Livanius.
Exactly. So, well, yes. they're really all these people are educated in that you know, that rhetorical culture stuff. Yeah. But that's just another kind of little help for your argument. Yeah.
Yes.
I wasn't completely convinced by that quotation that you gave, that you also put on the handout, of the 5th century sermon. When you read that text out to me, I thought the writer had been rather careful to specify what the different voices were. So in a sense, I don't think you'd need a second speaker in that particular instance, because he keeps saying, and also the way he says those he says's, in the middle, it tends to make me think that you could actually do that very effectively with just one voice, since he's made it very clear who's being quoted at each time.
Yes.
And the other thing I'd refer you to there is, I can't remember exactly where, but one of the figures of thought is a sort of dialogue where you ask a question and you answer it, or you pretend to put a position, and then, so within continuous speeches in ancient rhetoric, there is a tradition for a kind of dialogue going on, but clearly spoken by the main speaker, not using other voices. Though, of course, you know, your point about the other voices, that's probably where the various sorts of liturgical influence come in, isn't it? That we know that there are service books that show us people having different voices for, you know, somebody asks the question, who are you seeking? And then they say, we're seeking, that whole business. So I'm sure you're right about the way it goes from personification to dialogue, but exactly how it happens, one might want to shift. But I just felt that particular quote you gave, he did seem to mark the different voices so carefully that you wouldn't need more than one speaker. Whereas in an actual play, you never mark the different speakers that clearly. You don't need to, because you've got the different voices already coming, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes. You have only the names.
But that wouldn't be part of the spoken text.
Yes, yes. But you mean the 5th century Latin one?
Yes.
This one,
yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes. Because that's true, because it was paraphrased.
Yes.
When it was used in the liturgical books, it was paraphrased in a poetic way.
Yeah.
And now it's rhyming verse, which they are singing here.
Yeah.
And all the speakers are referred to with, not with the names, but there is the reader, the lector, who is calling them.
Yeah.
And then comes, it's only responsorium.
Yeah.
So it's a response,
sure,
which is given by the choir.
So, yes. So when it's adapted from the sermon into the liturgical use, that's when you get the different voices.
Yes, yes, yes. But the whole thing was created before. Mm-hmm. So the whole personification and the dialogue was there, present in the text.
Yeah.
And they have actually found it. And for this particular reason, which we don't exactly know, they wanted to represent it in such a way. So that's the question, that they had it before themselves in the text for quite a long time.
Sure.
And in a sudden moment, they decided to represent, to act it out.
Yeah.
And that's the question that should be answered.
Sure. But I mean, I think we can think of parallel things that also happen in other liturgical forms, can't we? The other evidence, this is very dim in my mind, but I seem to remember that we have examples, don't we, of cathedrals where they have lists of their possessions. And some of their possessions look like props that were being used for acted out parts of the service. So that there's some quite good evidence of the way in which a procession or a part of the service might turn from a dialogue between clerics into almost a play. Or
just a curiosity, how is related this sort of proto-theatrical expression with things such as the Passion readings, where there are multiple voices because there are multiple characters in a narrative which is given? What is the kind of connection? Because basically these are forms of, so to say, theatrical action which are all taking place within liturgy, not like a Passion or a sermon, like in the way you are suggesting, or the Ordo Preparum.
Yes.
How would you relate one with each other?
Yes, that's a difficult question, because it's very much analyzed nowadays that if the liturgical plays and the actual dramatic performances of the late Middle Ages, what we have in the cycle and Passion plays, is there any connection between the two?
Mm-hmm.
And scholars nowadays tend to answer the question with a no. So they are interpreting these things which we have seen as parts of the liturgy, because even in the Greek liturgy, which is not acted out like this, we have dialogue forms. We have these dialogue homilies in Greek. We have dialogues, liturgical poetry, in the liturgical poetry of the Byzantine tradition, which is not acted out at all. And we have the Syriac dialogue poems as well, which we were reading for quite a long time now, and they are not acted out. But they are genuine dialogues, very lively dialogues between Joseph and Mary, and they are not acted out. So nowadays, scholars say that this was liturgy, part of the liturgy. And after that, there was a kind of a sudden feel of something is missing, and they wanted to have representations in an actually present form. And that was the reason of the appearance of the theatre. And it could be the reason for the appearance of this particular Ordo Profetarum in costumes, that the practice of representing something in the on the stage was already existing at that time, and that was a reaction of that onto the liturgical tradition. So the liturgical tradition was not acted out in costumes and masks in the early times. It was just happening like this, without any kind of theatrical, you know, flavor in it. And after that, in a certain time, when something changed in the medieval Western culture, they wanted to represent it in a more persuasive way, and that could have an effect and influence on the liturgy as well. That's my interpretation.
So when you say those dialogues, like the Syriac ones and so on, they were not acted out, you mean that there was a single voice? Or
no, they were performed antiphonally. Okay. So there was one choir on the one side and the other one on the other side, and they were answering themselves. That's why Sebastian always tells us that only the half of the liturgical poem is extant, because they were made for only the choir on the left-hand side. And we have only the roles of Mary, for example, and we don't have the answers of Joseph, because it belonged to the other choir. And when he edits and publishes these poems, he has to bring the two manuscripts together, and after that reconstruct the poem. So that's again a kind of proof that they were not acted out, I think.
Is it a proof? Mm. I mean, not necessarily.
Yes, because there were several types of those manuscripts which contained theatrical pieces from the later Middle Ages. There were several types of copies. There was the Dirigierrolle in German, which was the director's copy. So there were no texts in it, only the movements. So he should go there and he should appear there, and that was another copy. There were actors' copies as well. So they had only their roles listed on a particular leaf. And it didn't contain the whole play, so that's right. In this sense, you are right. But what we actually know is what we know from Sebastian Brock, that all what he could find was a very, very, how to say, simple acting out of a certain dialogue when the robber was crucified with Christ after acquiring the death, wanted to enter the paradise, but the angels did not allow him to enter. And there is a deacon who is acting as the angel who wants to refute the robber from entering the paradise. And this is acted out in a very primitive way as between a deacon in white and a lector, perhaps, who is reciting the role of the robber in the church. But there is no costume or any kind of scenery.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question, but we have to get back to the So if there's one more question, okay, well, thank you very much, Peter. Very, very wide-ranging, very informative, and lots of texts which I'm sure were new to most of us. So thank you very much indeed.